right, I'm going to go ahead and get started. So just to remember where we are, Paul is in trouble, as usual. He's actually spent a couple of years under arrest in Caesarea, which is the kind of Roman city in Palestine on the seaside. Hi, Barbara. And now he has appealed his case to Rome. And there's a relatively new governor of the region who Paul has appealed his case to Rome. The new governor doesn't want to send this guy to Rome on his own authority because this reads to him like a religious issue, not so much as something of Roman law. So he's roped in King Agrippa, who is the client king of the region, right? And he's roped him in to see if he can come up with effectively an indictment to about Paul that he can send along with him to the emperor. But Felix, the governor, really wants King Agrippa's name on the indictment because he'd rather he take the blame rather than Felix.
So who is Felix again?
Felix is the Roman governor of the province of Galilee. Technically, King Agrippa is the king of Judea. These are the two areas kind of right next to each other, Judea and Galilee. But the lines aren't exactly that clear. It's not like states in the United States. The roles and the authorities are a little bit mingled between the two.
So these two places, Galilee and Judea, they're the land of Israel, the Jews.
The land of Israel and a little bit more. It would be part of what is today Israel and Syria, and not all of Syria, but a little bit of Syria, much of what is today Jordan.
At that time, what percentage of the people were Jewish?
Basically, the only people, well, that's not maybe not quite true, probably about 90% are Jewish. The other people are Roman officials who are there, Roman soldiers who are there, and a few traders and migrants and other kinds of people. You also have the Samaritans who worship the God of Israel but technically aren't Jewish. At least the Jews wouldn't call them Jewish. The Samaritans would have called themselves Jewish. But
within Judea and
yes.
Galilee.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we are going to pick this up.
What chapter?
Chapter 25. And I'm going to pick up with verse 23. All right. Chapter 25, verse 23. So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice, Bernice is Agrippa's wife, came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then Festus gave the order, and Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish community petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he should not live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And when he appealed to his imperial majesty, I decided to send him. But I have nothing definite to write to our sovereign about him. Therefore I have brought him before all of you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner without indicating the charges against him. So there's this big assembly. The king and the queen are sitting there. All of the kind of tribunes and officials and court are around them. And so Festus is setting out the case. All right? Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
So what he's saying is, here's where we are, and this is why we've gathered. So this is the biblical version of the, I imagine you're wondering why I've called you all here today, speech. Okay? So, now we're going to get to the heart of it. So I'm picking up at the beginning of chapter 26. Agrippa said to Paul, "You have permission to speak for yourself." Then Paul stretched out his hand and began to defend himself. "I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I am to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, because you are especially familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. All the Jews know my way of life from my youth, a life spent from the beginning among my own people and in Jerusalem. They have known for a long time, if they are willing to testify, that I have belonged to the strictest sect of our religion and lived as a Pharisee. And now I stand here on trial on account of my hope in the promise made by God to our ancestors, a promise that our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly worship day and night. It is for this hope, Your Excellency, that I am accused by the Jews. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead?" All right, so I'm going to stop here. So here's Paul setting the case, right? First of all, he butters up King Agrippa a little bit, right? "I'm glad it's before you, King Agrippa, because you understand, you know, you understand that this is really an interfaith issue we're having. If they will tell you the truth, they will tell you, I am a Pharisee. I am a strict Pharisee, and I was raised that way. And it is because I believe in the resurrection that really all of our people should be praying for that I'm on trial here." So he's laying the case out that this doesn't have anything to do with the Romans. This is a fight between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, right? And it's about whether there really is resurrection from the dead or not.
So that's the main difference? I know you talked about this before, sorry.
Right, yeah, that's okay. That's the main difference. The Sadducees claim there is no resurrection. The Pharisees claim that there is resurrection at the coming of the Messiah.
So they're both Jewish.
They're both Jewish. These are both Jewish parties. What Paul is doing is putting on the jersey of the Pharisees and saying, "I'm a Pharisee, and they're out to get me because they're Sadducees." All right? It's like, you know, he put on an Ohio State jersey and said, "They're only against me because they're from Michigan." Okay? That one speaks to me. It doesn't need to speak to you. So.
What about the 12 tribes?
The 12 tribes are that's the nation of Israel. Right, the 12 tribes of Israel?
Right, right, yeah.
So what he's saying is all of our people should be believing in this. Okay? So this is where he's laying the foundation of his case.
In this day and age, do the Jewish people know what tribe the belong to?
No.
Their ancestors?
Generally not. That's been, with the diaspora, that bit has been lost. Some of them claim to, but over the centuries, that's been kind of lost. All right. So I'm picking up at verse 9. "Indeed, I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things against the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and that is what I did in Jerusalem with authority received from the chief priests. I not only locked up many of the saints in prison, but I also cast my vote against them when they were being condemned to death. By punishing them often in all the synagogues, I tried to force them to blaspheme. And since I was so furiously enraged at them, I pursued them even to foreign cities." So he's laying out his bona fides. He's saying, I'm not one of those Christians who originally followed this rabble-rouser. I'm not a zealot. In fact, I'm one of the ones who originally sought to enforce the law against them. All right? So he's laying out his bona fides.
Is he doing that truly in belief that he is not part of the movement for Christ?
No. He claims to be a follower of Christ. What he's doing is explaining how he got where he was.
Okay, but he's not denying that he believes that Christ is the Messiah.
Oh, no. No. Okay. He's giving the king his history. And part of his history, and part of the reason the king should believe him, is that he wasn't one of the people who was taken in by the charismatic zealot.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So now we're getting to the heart of it.
Vicki?
Yes.
Question.
Sure.
He's talking about being able to bring the Christians to trial to mm-hmm. punish them even to death.
Mm-hmm.
Who had the authority to do that? It wasn't the priests, but it wasn't a civil matter under the governor either, was it?
Well, the way, at least when at the beginning that it worked, was the religious authorities captured them on religious charges, tried them on religious charges, and then turned them over to the civil authorities saying, these people are rabble-rousers. They're more of that group of troublemakers of that Jesus of Nazareth, that zealot you executed. These are more of them.
Okay, so it's more like disturbing the peace
yes.
in a major way, or
yes.
rioting or violence among the people, but not
yeah.
the religious belief, the government.
That's right. Yeah. The secular authorities weren't really going after the Christians because they really weren't actually causing trouble. But the religious authorities, if they caught the Christians and tried them and then turned them over to the secular authorities, remember that this is not a time when equal justice under law is a thing. The Romans don't care that much about justice. They care about control. So if the religious authorities say these people are troublemakers...
So what's the punishment?
Whatever the Roman authority decides it is. Anything from scourging to imprisonment to crucifixion. And really, crucifixion was really the default. They just didn't have time. They didn't have a criminal justice system like we do. So if you're accused of disturbing the peace, you're likely to be executed. If you're accused of theft, you're likely to be executed. If you're accused of bodily harm, you're likely to be executed. That's, all of that is just likely to end in execution because it's simply easier than trying to figure it out. They don't actually have a prison system. They may have a couple of cells to hold people in, but it's not like imprisonment is a punishment.
Paul's been in prison for 2 years now, right?
Right, he's a political prisoner.
Okay.
And they have cells to hold political prisoners.
Literally in a jail type of situation?
No, this wasn't house arrest. He was held in a cell in the governor's palace. And there might have been four cells there. But just like for thousands of years, including until relatively recently in history, even though you're in prison, that doesn't mean you're shut off. And I'll bring it up into modern times. If you were imprisoned in the Tower of London, up until really the 20th century, if you had money, you could have a servant with you, you could have food brought in for you, you could have wine brought in for you, you could have, furniture and books and all those things, you could have visitors. So, you know, and that was true in Roman times too. If you're being held and you have friends, you can live relatively comfortably in prison, you just can't leave. So, it's, don't think of prison like Attica, because it's not that kind of thing.
So did they have to have somebody bring food in, like the hospitals? The hospitals, you had to have somebody bring food in.
You didn't have to have somebody bring food in. You could, your jailer, the person in charge of the jail, was actually responsible for feeding the prisoners. But if you didn't have food brought in, or if you didn't pay your jailer for better food, you were likely to get whatever the leftovers were. So it behooved you to either pay your jailer or have friends bring you food. Again, not like our prison system today where they employed people to provide food for the prisoners. So, okay, so I'm picking up at verse 12. With this in mind, I was traveling to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. When midday along the road, Your Excellency, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining around me and my companions. When we all had fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew language, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It hurts you to kick against the goads." I asked, "Who are you, Lord?" The Lord answered, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But get up and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you to serve and testify to the things in which you have seen me, and to those in which I will appear to you. I will rescue you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes, so that they may turn from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, so that they may receive forgiveness of sins, and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me." So this is Paul's description of what happened to him on the road to Damascus, right? So what he's saying to the king is, I was doing my duty. I was headed to Damascus to pick up those Christians. And look, I encountered Jesus in person on the road. And that changed my life. So, no. He did this to the apostles at the Ascension.
In that same way, though, of saying, you know, this is now what I want you to do.
And if you remember at the Ascension, and if you don't, it's at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. As he rose up, he goes, "You are my witnesses."
This sounds so cut and dry. I mean, this is it. There's no doubt about what I'm telling you.
Right, and the same thing in Matthew. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. You are my witnesses to Jerusalem and to the Gentiles and to the ends of the earth. That's Jesus speaking to his disciples in Matthew.
That was decades before.
I'm sorry?
That was decades before.
Decades before. That was 40 days after Easter.
Yeah, that was decades before.
Mm-hmm.
Coming forth.
Mm-hmm.
Where all those the apostles passed away and the movement grew just a little bit and
well now remember that while Paul is saying this to King Agrippa, it's been decades. But when this happened to Paul, it was within 2 years of the resurrection. Remember that this happened very early. Paul going to Damascus and seeing Jesus on the road to Damascus was really early in the Christian movement, within 2 years.
Of the resurrection?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize. I thought Paul really
for decades now.
Okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to fit in the time frame. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the conversion is very early. And then he spends decades, literally, going around on the journeys we've been reading about. Right?
Okay, now I got it.
All right.
Didn't he get more credibility, though, by reminding them of what he formerly was doing?
Yes. Yes. And remember that his goal right now is to convince the king that this is really a religious fight. That this is an internecine fight among the Jews, and that it doesn't impact the Romans at all. Right? So, okay. So, now we're going to hear what happens, Paul telling his own story about what happens next. After that, King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but declared first to those in Damascus and then in Jerusalem and throughout the countryside of Judea and also to the Gentiles that they should repent and turn to God and do deeds consistent with repentance. For this reason, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. To this day, I have had help from God, and so I stand here testifying to both small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would take place, that the Messiah must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. So this is Paul finishing up his defense. So he's saying, I obeyed God. God appeared to me. I obeyed him. I went to Damascus and then Jerusalem and then all over the place. But all I was doing, King Agrippa, was proclaiming what Moses said would happen. That the Messiah would come, that he would be put to death, and that he would be the first to rise from the dead. So that's his defense, is this is a completely inter-religious fight, and the Sadducees are out to get me because I proclaimed the resurrection, and the Jewish leaders are out to get me because they didn't recognize the Messiah. But none of this has anything to do with the emperor. So if you want to send me to the emperor, fine. That, you know, I declare he needs to have the judgment of my case, but you got to send it as a religious argument, not that I was stirring up trouble. You know, I'm not a breaker of the peace. I'm not proclaiming against the emperor. I'm not a rebel. I'm not a zealot.
But it was Paul that pushed the appeal to Rome.
Yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
And exactly because he wants this to happen. He wants to stand in the place of saying, I have the right to have my case heard by the emperor, and if you're not willing to let me go and dismiss the case, you're going to have to send me there, but you're going to have to do it on the basis of these facts, not claiming to me to be a rebel or a disturber of the peace. Okay? So what he's trying to do is get Agrippa and Festus, the governor. I think I called him Felix earlier. That was the previous governor. He's trying to get Agrippa and Festus between a rock and a hard place. And he's got them there. He's done pretty well.
So why does Paul want to go to be judged in Rome?
He doesn't really want them to send him to Rome, but he doesn't want them to make the decision locally. He wants to give them, he wants to put Festus and Agrippa in the place where the only choices they have are to let him go or send him to the emperor. He doesn't want them to be able to judge him guilty and punish him, because he's worried that they'll be influenced by the Jewish leaders. So his first choice, I'm sure, is decide this isn't worth sending to the emperor. You don't want to be on the emperor's radar screen for this. Let me go. His second choice is send me to the emperor. And then his third choice would be judge the case yourself, but he's very afraid of what might happen if that's true. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. So I'm picking up at verse 24. While he was making this defense, Festus exclaimed, "You are out of your mind, Paul. Too much learning is driving you insane." But Paul said, "I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking the sober truth. Indeed, the king knows about these things, and to him I speak freely, for I am certain that none of these things has escaped his notice. For this was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe." Agrippa said to Paul, "Are you so quickly persuading me to become a Christian?" Paul replied, "Whether quickly or not, I pray to God that not only you, but also all who are listening to me today may become such as I am, except for these chains." So Festus, who is the Roman, says, "You really believe in this resurrection stuff, and you actually believe that Jesus guy was raised from the dead? You study too much, you're crazy," right? This is where the "much learning has driven thee mad" that Shakespeare quotes comes from. But Paul says, politely, but firmly, "I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to Agrippa. And Agrippa knows what the prophets said, that the Messiah would be raised from the dead. He believes that. That when the Messiah comes, the Messiah will be raised from the dead." And Agrippa says, you know, now Agrippa's in front of this whole Roman cohort. He's got to say something. So he says, "Are you trying to get me to become a Christian this quickly?" And Paul says, "Whether quickly or not, hey, I don't care, but I pray God that everyone who hears me will be exactly as I am, that is, believe as I am, except for the fact that I'm here in chains before you." And he's probably not in physical chains, metaphor.
Who all's in the room right now?
Agrippa and Beatrice and Festus, the king, and their court. So they're officials and hangers-on.
Oh, okay, so there could be quite a few people.
Probably about 50 or 60 people. This is a tourist attraction, right? Anybody who can get themselves in is going to be in here. Remember, they don't have Netflix, so they got to find other kinds of entertainment. So, all right, other questions about that?
Just out of curiosity, kind of a side question, is Judea and Galilee, are they kind of well-to-do country? I mean, are they profitable and no?
No, they're not. The reason it's important to the Romans to hold them is that they're part of the land route between Egypt and the empire. There's a sea route between Egypt and the empire, but they're the land route. So, and remember, they don't sail big ships, so if you really want to move goods, you got to move it through that area. So, yeah.
They're a poor country, and does the Roman government, tax the mildly and money off of them?
Oh yeah, the Romans tax all their conquered nations highly, but really for the Romans, the taxes are important, but probably the taxes that they get from Judea and Galilee just about pay for the soldiers and the government that they have there. So it's not like they're making a lot of money off the taxes. They're making a lot of money because they hold the route. So they don't have to pay anybody else tribute to get goods from Egypt to Rome.
Well, having the Roman soldiers there, isn't that sort of a security thing with all the other feuding groups in
Yep. They
to Judea. Did they have the Roman soldiers there to protect them?
Not to protect the people, to protect the trade route.
Okay.
Yeah.
But is it my color, but I'm protecting the people.
Protecting the city, but
it keeps peace.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, being the governor of Galilee, I think I've said this before, being the governor of Galilee is not not really high up in the Roman hierarchy. There's one of two reasons that you're the governor of Galilee. You're a relatively young man that they think might have promise and they want to try you out. Or you're a more senior guy and you've screwed up. And you haven't screwed up badly enough to be executed or kicked out, but you have to, they want you out of the way. So that's one of two reasons you're there. You're either a young man on your way up, or you're on your way down. My sense of Festus is that he's a young man on his way up, that this might be his first governorship, and he wants to do well. Okay? All right, I'm going to finish this up. Then the king got up, and with him the governor and Bernice and those who had been seated with them. And as they were leaving, they said to one another, "This man has done nothing to deserve death or imprisonment." Agrippa said to Festus, "This man could have been set free if he had not appealed to the emperor." Well, he probably could have, but since he had publicly appealed to the emperor, Festus feels like he needs to send him. So, but Agrippa's saying, "There's nothing here I'm going to put my name to. No, I don't see a crime here." And you all heard on Sunday, right, the story of Pontius Pilate and Jesus?
Uh-huh.
He's done nothing deserving of death. "I wash my hands of it," says Pilate. So here's another Roman governor, a generation later, saying the same thing about Paul. He's done nothing deserving of death. But we're going to get him out of our way anyway. I'm sorry, Sue.
In one of the prophecies that Jesus made, didn't he say to Paul that, "Yes, you will suffer the same as me"?
No, he said that to Peter. He said that to Peter.
Okay.
Who did suffer the same.
Yes.
So.
But there are quite a few similarities between
Paul's story and Jesus, yes. And some of that is coincidence, and some of that I think is intentional on the part of Luke to draw the distinction, you know, to draw the similarities to our attention.
And why would he do that?
To enhance Paul's authority. Because remember, Luke is basing all his teachings on Paul's teachings. So he wants to bolster Paul's authority. Okay. Other questions about this? All right. Next week, same time, we will get Paul, hopefully, to Rome and see how the story ends.
We're going to finish Acts.
I'm hoping we'll finish Acts next week. We'll have two chapters. So if we can get through two chapters, we'll get through two chapters. If not, we'll finish Acts the week after. But we'll get into Rome.
Is Thessalonians that you said we're going to do next?
First.
Chronologically?
Chronologically, yes. We're taking the books in chronological order. So 1 Thessalonians is the first book that Paul wrote, or the earliest book that Paul wrote. Okay? All right, have a happy Easter, everyone.
Easter, everybody.
Easter.
Yeah. We'll see you face to face.
No, you won't. Yes, have a blessed Easter.
Yeah.
blessed Easter to all of you.
Yes, thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.